Okay? Right, we're going to deal now with the second axiom, that if change is to take place, then we require a certain type of individuals. Now, this is one of the reasons why I kept pushing you this morning and yesterday. It's not sufficient to say build community. It's not sufficient to say conversion. We have to specify how that takes place. And it takes place ultimately because there are certain individuals that have gifts that others haven't got. And that's not a very popular truth to face, as we will see. Now, let me give you some examples. Some of us here remember what it was like after Vatican II when missals and hymn books proliferated just out of the sky, one after the other. I can remember celebrating Mass once with 9 separate missals on the altar. You needed a guidebook to find out which one you went to next. So, you can understand what frustration must be like for somebody singing in a choir of a cathedral. In this particular situation, it was the cathedral of Minneapolis and Paul, the Twin Cities. And this was a layman. And he'd got there early before the Sunday Mass. He'd seen what the hymns were to be, and he marked the hymns with things like this. Pieces of paper that he could move in and out. Fine. He was already prepared now to participate meaningfully in the liturgy for the glory of God. All was well, all was predictable, all was in order. Order, order. What happened? No. No.
The organ didn't work.
No. He sneezed, and the consequence of which, the markers fell out, and for the rest of the Mass, chaos. The choir was deprived of his vocal gifts because he went into a state of chaos and confusion, of pain and loss. He kept saying to himself, this cannot go on, I have got to solve the problem. And he belonged to the company 3M. And you can guess what happened. Right, he set about devising the 3M sticker. Post-it, did it? Okay. Why didn't you think about it? It brought in millions into 3M company. Millions. He looked for a type of sticker that could go on to paper but could be recycled without tearing the paper. You could drop your hymn book and all would be well because it would still stick so that the glory of God could be fully expressed without ongoing chaos. Why didn't you think of it? It took him to think of it. It took him to own up to the chaos and to do something about it, which meant pushing management, which meant pushing scientific sections of 3M Company to come up with the right type of glue. And he would not give up. Stubborn, stubborn, stubborn. But out of this came creativity, creativity, creativity. In New Zealand, there are what we call mud pools. You have them in Yellowstone Park, don't you, where Yogi Bear and Boo Boo live. Is it Yellowstone Park? Yogi. Yogi and Boo Boo. Is it Yellowstone Park? Jellystone Park. Oh, okay. You have boiling mud in the national park, don't you? Okay. But you've never done anything about it. You've never done anything about it, have you? But you see, it took a New Zealand to do something about it. Creativity. We have them, you see, big holes in the ground with boiling mud. Grey, like your shirt there, John, like the shirt. And it, you see, it's very thick, and every night it goes, boom, boom, boom. And for centuries, local people have been cooking their breakfasts there. And they would lower the breakfast in a fibre bag. But sometimes they fell in themselves, which led to vitamin nutritional reaction for other people who cook their breakfasts subsequently. Because once in, you never get out. Mm-hmm. So, for centuries this happened, until one New Zealander kept visiting these mud pools, and the guides got very anxious. What's he going to do? Jump in? So they watched him. He kept coming back day after day after day for weeks. Until one day he jumped up and the guards got very, very anxious. He said, I have got it! What did he have? What did he got? He discovered that these mud pools could be turned into thermal energy. That pipes could be laid under the mud pools and the steam taken out to turn turbines which produced high-class electricity. If you can imagine, there is high-class and low-class electricity. So that the consequence is that this little country is dependent significantly upon thermal power. But it took one person to come up with that insight. No amount of committee meeting, no amount of general chapters, God help us, no amount of provincial chapters, Lord have mercy upon us for saying that, can produce a quantum leap in thinking. You can meet in chapter for decades without coming up with a quantum creative leap in any way whatsoever. Is that a surprise? How do you think? It's not. But unlike you people, it's not normally recognized that certain people, not others, have certain gifts to create quantum leap-like beyond the predictable, and others haven't got that ability. These people have above-average gifts of imagination. These people have above-average gifts of stubbornness. I will solve this problem. To hang with you, I will solve it. Even though it takes me 10 years. They keep at it, 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 they keep at it. Imagination and drive, and they are not loners. They're not individualists. They recognize that they cannot solve the problem themselves. They need the cooperation of management. They need the cooperation of people who can make glue. So they're not loners, which is critically important. Now, the first, it's a key axiom. Change of the quantum leap kind requires certain type of people. But the problem is, what about the group? All the group, believe me, can write the most marvelous mission statements about creativity for change. Or they can sit around and write beautiful vision statements about conversion. But nothing happens. Nothing happens. Do you find that happening? Nothing happening? But you do find the mission statements beautiful? They can be very beautiful, particularly when they come back for revision 5 years later. Nothing's happened. I'm not against vision statements. I'm not against mission statements. But I am against assuming that writing the statement immediately solves the problem. It's what we call in anthropology plain, simple magic. That doesn't work. Is talking about it, writing about it, nothing happens. So we're up against the problem of the group. You see, just for a moment now, how would you feel if I decided that today it would be a very good idea, sisters and brothers and sisters, to start lecturing from the rear?
Isn't it interesting that only three people turn around and look at me? Why is it that you still remain facing that window? And here I am, I have decided to lecture from the rear. And I have decided from now on, I'm lecturing with a hat on. Because I like to wear a hat when I lecture. I'm getting three or four hours, I'm getting to take a glance at what I look like. But no one yet has really turned their seat around. Why don't you turn your seat around? Why is it? You're hoping that I will be seduced into going back to lecture to the front then. That's right, because therefore you are expressing a certain degree of what?
Inertia.
Not just inertia.
Control.
Control? You want to control me, you want to seduce me back up there. Well, I won't go back up there. Put that where you think there might be more.
You will. You'll go back.
You see what I mean? Here we are having a workshop on basically creativity for change. We've broken one predictability. You now don't sit normally in the same seat you sat at because it's too embarrassed to. But you don't like still lingering up there. So I decided if you change, I change. Okay? Now, brothers and sisters, there's a key, very, very fundamental truth in what is happening. Very fundamental truth. And what is the truth? Can you tell me now? What is the truth? One of the key truths of this week, one of the most powerful truths of this week, what is it?
Individual is subservient to the group.
Yes, 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 yes. Yes, that's true, that's part of the truth.
Resistance to change.
Really, yes, from somebody who's got his back fully.
Yes,
but that's how creativity takes place, ultimately. Now we see, we're looking now at how does the group react to somebody who challenges the status quo. Even in a workshop, Peter and Ed learning about how to lead creative jumps for pastoral ministry.
Opposition, isn't it?
Opposition. Why the opposition?
Because you're not performing.
You are comfortable.
I'm uncomfortable.
You're uncomfortable with what?
Yes,
with
me.
Why are you uncomfortable?
Because I'm going to have to do something.
You are going to have to do something about it. That is a crucial learning truth of this week. What is it that the human person and the human group most yearn for? Order. Predictability. And when that predictability is threatened, what begins to happen? Resistance because of what? Because the anxiety level rises, because the predictability of order is threatened. Remember that you have seduced me, I now retire, I have lost all creativity. And now
can you make phones up here?
And my microphone is up here. Now you feel, I can sense the anxiety level now calming down with happiness on your faces. If I'd stayed another half an hour, you would have a sore neck, you see. But your chair would not, one moved the chair. One moved the chair. One sat in a position wisely where he could look at the back and look at the front without any minimal change. That's creativity. Now, as I said, this is a critically important truth when we speak of the whole resistance to refounding religious life. I have workshop after workshop, when I first started, with the theory. They loved it. They shouted in joy over it. They even went back and wrote another mission statement in light of the vision. And what happened? Nothing. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. Because ideally speaking, the group should facilitate the creativity. In actual fact, deep down, it's not conscious, it's down here. Deep down, the resistance to the creative person builds itself up into an anxiety level that seeks to seduce the energy of the creative person. I'm supposed to be, as I said, an authority of change. I tell everybody else how to do it. But I discover I'm sitting in the same seat often over and over again. And on the staff in the seminary, the change agent supreme. But I found myself, without realizing it at first, that I was controlling the agenda of the weekly meetings of the staff. Do you know why? And I was embarrassed to own up to it. Because there was a member of the staff, when it came to any matters of urgency, he would raise the question, which I did not want to hear. What is the purpose of training seminarians 10 miles out in the countryside? What is the purpose of this seminary? I did not want to hear that question. For what reason? My entire world would collapse. So I would so structure the agenda that I'd allow him, if he was lucky, a minute at the end. And of course I would always win. I was a chairman. Shrewd. But at first I was not aware of what I was doing. Then it became a conscious act, and I became guilty. And I expressed sorrow to the Lord. Now, yes.
Father, you're saying that...
Jerry.
When you go through this whole process, you're describing that nothing happened. People went back and nothing
happened. Very commonly, nothing happens, yes.
Okay, isn't it... I'm thinking of like the 3M thing. It took a while for this man to go around and move these people. The geist or whatever it was. It took him a while to look and think.
Yes.
Don't you think the change started within you in, say, 1976? And it's not that no change was happening, but that... it just takes a while for change to happen.
Well, that's true. It takes a while for change to happen, but my experience is the vast amount of talking on change produces nothing. Nothing happens. Literally nothing happens. Sometimes we make a distinction between what we call reactive change and proactive. For example, take the seminary I was running. Okay. Good. Fine. Excellent. Beautiful establishment on a mountain. Mount St. Mary's on a hill. Oh, beautiful. A mile drive from people from the world up to the mountain. Now, it took another 10 to 15 years for that province of our congregation to realize you simply could not turn around that which was unturnaroundable. It was a structure built for another era of formation, monastic structures and so on. No matter what you try to do within it, it wouldn't change the atmosphere. But, so I wasn't entirely in fault myself, but the writing was clearly on the wall. We could not do that. It was clear for 20 years. And we had conversations about it. But we didn't do anything about it until finally we had so few students that you could feel ancestors rattling their bones through the corridors. Mm-hmm. We're closing off sections until finally we realized we made a reactive judgment instead of proactive. We reacted to the crisis. Now, some people don't react to crises. They just die without reacting to anything.
If you would challenge the system, they would send you home.
Yes, yes, yes. Send you home because the anxiety level resulting from the fear of change seduces the energy of the person, or seeks to seduce the energy. Or what does it do? When the group doesn't want the change, what happens to the individual?
Kill the prophet.
Marginalize the prophet. Or, oh, glory be to God, brother, we've got a new mission in Patagonia. I'm sure you'd be interested in Patagonia. Now, this is normal. This is a normal process of what we call marginalization. Those of you who on Friday morning will remember the case I gave of what I call witch hunting. The marginalization of the group. You had a character in the United States, a fascinating character called Joseph Senator McCarthy, didn't you? Yeah? 1950. Now, why was 1950 a critical period in the group life of this United States? Those older people amongst us now, we younger people need to be told what was going on.
The fear of communism?
The fear of communism. You were losing the war in Korea, I understand, I'm told. The American dream of success. God is on our side, thank you, God is on our side, wasn't particularly working itself out rightly. You were having failures internationally. So you sought a scapegoat, or a series of them, to blame for the crisis. True? So you, McCarthy, articulated the witches, and people like you and me, highly rational, highly logical, suddenly said, he's right. He locked in on the irrationality of the group, the fears of the group about change. Do you see what I mean? That's a normal reaction to the fear of change. Okay? Here is a perfect example of it. Of the problem. IBM. IBM is now in grave difficulty. As you know, it was the biggest, the most powerful, the most successful computer company in the entire world. What's happening to it now? It's falling apart. Others are coming in. Toshiba, Compaq are coming in and stealing the goodies. And IBM doesn't know what to do. But I can tell you, it has a very, very fine mission statement about change and support of the creative people. I've seen it. It's beautiful. And they often have it in very finely framed pictures on the walls. But IBM is crumbling because it failed to own the mission statement. It failed to live with anxiety constructively. You see, from the very beginning we've had this problem of people who ask the question, what if there is another way of doing it? And the chap with the wheelbarrow, look, you can't say that he's encouraging, can you? You wouldn't say he's very enthusiastic about a wheel instead of this dreadful thing that goes clockety, 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 clock, right? No, there is a built-in resistance in fallen humankind to the fear of the change. And even when we are at our most creative moments in the bath, then lo and behold, what happens? Somebody says it's not Caruso when we have every intention of making it Caruso. That's the sort of reaction you get. Have you ever had that reaction? Many times. If you kept going, If you kept trying to sing now, have you been seduced into silence? I hope not. Keep singing. People may disappear, but that doesn't matter. Keep at it. Keep going. You see, back last century, there was an Irishman. Any Irish here? Oh, of course there, yes. Well, you see, there was this Anglican Church of Ireland man, as you know, Dean Swift, who decided that the British were too much insistent on the bureaucracy. So he wrote the story about Gulliver's Travels. It was really a satire for adults. But it was too difficult for adults. They did not want to own it. So it became a children's book. But it's really for adults. Because bureaucrats from England were becoming so concerned about details and the failure to keeping the status quo, that Dean Swift wrote the satire about Gulliver as a giant in Lilliput land. And Lilliput land was really government bureaucracy. It seems to me, from my humble experience, that that might well be written of many religious congregations. You see, here we are here. This is updated religious life. You see, he's got the computer now. You see? He's Nigrin and Eucharitis writing their reports on religious life in the United States. But the reactions we are getting from some people is, oh, they're too dangerous. Tie them down. Little people running all over them. Oh, well dressed. Very well dressed. Good hats. Very good hats. But very negative. Because they create fear of the unpredictable. Okay, now, can you immediately see any applications of all this to religious life? You're nodding your head very sagely.
You've got to get updated, that's for
sure.
You've got to get updated. Stay with
yes.
The change of the times.
Yes, but it's true.
I can, but I want to ask a question.
Please. You can't or you can?
I can.
Right. Even for the Dominicans? Oh. Right, go on.
The point is, though,
yes.
That is it not true that after some sort of perhaps watershed, or even when some new leader helps the group refocus its vision, etc., that to some degree the new religious life, let's say, that comes forward, is going to have a certain amount of predictability? We can't live without predictability.
No, that's quite correct. It's quite correct. Yes. It's not chaos or structure. It's both. You've always got to have a mixture of a chaos and structure. Otherwise, you can't have change. But the tension is that you become so locked in on the chaos that you get overpowered by it and you will not move. You get paralyzed. Who, you know, there was any English people here? Any followers of Charlie Dickens? Anybody read lately Great Expectations? Great Expectations. Who was the lady who was jilted? Miss Havisham. She, you see, went to be married. And she got to the church. What was the name?
That was the girl.
It was the girl. Right. She went to the church, but the husband-to-be didn't turn up. She was jilted, in other words, at the altar. So she was pictured in Great Expectations 25 to 30 years later, sitting in the banquet room for the wedding breakfast, with rats running in and out of the cakes, waiting for the groom. She was in what we might be calling now an overdose, a severe overdose of the denial. Because the husband-to-be certainly wasn't coming. I guess he was already dead. He'd gone off with somebody else. You see, it's you can get so locked in the chaos that you don't use it as a springboard for the change. The other temptation, which I find probably greater, is the temptation to get locked in on the permanency of structures. Any other questions? Can you see applications? Yes.
Question. You've mentioned success stories. You've mentioned the post-it notes and things like that. You've mentioned success stories. I look at religious congregations, particularly of women here in the United States, who did that quantum leap of refounding, and now are looking back in light of, for example, the study by
Eucharitis and yes,
looking back and saying, "Gee, maybe it shouldn't have been that." With their structures of government, for example, looking back, the way they formed individual ministries and stuff like that, they took the quantum leap, and it turned out. Yeah, but I mean, it's easy for us to look at it now.
Oh, yes.
Monday morning quarterback, look back and say, "Well, they should have done."
Yeah.
How do you deal with, you know, an intelligent quantum leap as opposed to whatever?
Well, the important is a key one here. It is we need to invent a system whereby we don't get tangled up in the cords too. First of all, I wouldn't call it refounding, as we'll see tomorrow. Because refounding has to be based on a vision of religious life and the charism of the congregation. And in some instances, the refounding, in inverted commas, has been, as I will point out tomorrow, absorption into the cultural methods of government that are purely secular and don't fit with religious life. So, refounding, as we will see, IBM, for example, if it's going to speak of refounding, it has to speak of refounding computers. It's not into making toys. It has to be within the context and the vision of IBM, not of Ford Detroit, for example. Whatever it might want to do, it's not refounding computers. And this, again, is a problem that we've got to look at in religious life. But I want to come back to this one. Any other questions? Right, otherwise we'll go ahead, and I want to come back to this a little later. Keep all the time asking yourself, how does this apply in my experience? Yes?
Well, it seems now like our group, our structures are the same, but before a superior made a decision, that was it. Now he makes a decision, our own reply to that decision, if he hasn't discussed it thoroughly through meetings and all that stuff, well, shove that. You know, that's his decision. That's not mine. Hmm. And he can't change, and we can't change.
And the implication of that is?
Well, we're in a bind.
You just won't move.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'd like to come on to that also, this question of what do we mean by leadership? Because then you've got a problem emerging of individualism, which I want to come back to.
Sometimes the amount of energy that it takes to bring about change in an organization, sometimes individuals or an individual feels that it's easier to go out and form a new organization from the ground up rather than trying and put energy into changing the one that's in existence.
Right. Now, did you hear that comment? That's a crucial comment, and I'll put it onto the tape for you. The comment made is this: often or sometimes the frustration of bringing about change within a group is so common, is so overwhelming, it's easier to go out of the group and use the energy elsewhere. That is absolutely true. And that's what I call the new belongs elsewhere. In fact, here is something that is scary. This is scary. The implications frighten me no end. As an anthropologist, the possibility of turning around dramatically an existing institution with its existing structures is nil.
Oh,
Good response, Dave. Oh, you're right. I'll state it again. The possibility, as an anthropologist, of turning around an institution with existing structures as they are is nil. As a theologian, I would take it also. And I want to come to that tomorrow, theologically. Biblically, I'll come to it. Now, what I've just said is a very, very powerful comment. And the only way to get the energy to move and to function for the good of the whole is to direct it around the groups, often. Most often. Now, that is frightening. It is very, very frightening. And the reason is, as an anthropologist, so powerful is the built-in resistance to change that even if the change appears to take place, the sustaining of it becomes, generally speaking, impossible because the resistance grows more and more. Now, for that reason, I say that refunding, I'm speaking here in very secular terms at the moment, refunding requires the cooperation of three types of people. Leadership, refunding people, and renewal people. And you cannot get it off the ground without the cooperation of these three people, these three types of people. And the role of the official leadership is, number one, to find out who these people are, who can be creative. People who can actually change a wheel on a car, for example. Renewal people. Refounding people, people who can invent, metaphorically, in pastoral life, the hovercraft. That's the primary task of the leadership, is to find them. And if you haven't got them, go out and buy them. Because you haven't got any future without them. No future without them. And the second aim of the leadership is to develop structures to protect the energy for the group. To allow the structures to develop whereby this energy is not seduced by the resistance. Ford 2, under Ford 1, as you probably know, the Ford company was almost close to death. He'd built the Model A. Can you remember the Model A? I do. I remember the old Fords with the wooden wheels. No, rubber around them, of course, but wooden spokes. The others, he would find that rather unusual. They're so young. Ford reached a point where that's what he wanted to produce. Having been successful, why change, he said. When Ford 2 or 3 took over, the last Henry Ford, he recognized he could not turn around at the existing institution, so for new models of car, he developed separate units, entire separate units. And the reason was, you cannot change that which cannot be changed. And the Japanese today, in buying up America, the automobile industry, what do? They have now come to the conclusion, do not buy existing automobile plants because you buy a culture of problems, labor problems, depression, union problems. So you go a distance away and you build entirely from the grassroots. Then you can move. You cannot change that which already exists. That is a very strong statement, and I want to come back to it. How many here... Has anybody here got a heart bypass? Congratulations. I have one. Yes. What's yours? Six or... Oh, gosh. You see, I've only got three.
I'll give you one.
Well, now, I think you and I have had heart bypasses in order to respond to the type of question that has come forward. And I'm grateful to God for the chaos. Not always, but in this case, yes. Do you know what a heart bypass is? No, they take veins from the legs, turn them upside down, and make them into arteries, because they have to turn them upside down, because otherwise they're still veins, and the blood goes away from the heart. That's on. That I didn't know about before. So that's a good definition of refunding. You turn it upside down. That's number one. Now, number two. You see, I only had three arteries that were clogged. Too much ice cream. Too much junk food. When young. So you've got a chance. You see, so what happened was, they recognized they couldn't pump the arteries. They couldn't clear them by pressing air through them. Wouldn't go. Too dangerous. So they recognized they had to bypass them. They didn't kill, finally, the old three arteries. But the three arteries had a meeting. And the three arteries here, the dying arteries, said, "We demand to live. We have every right to live. Don't let us die." They even wrote a mission statement on it. Yeah? Our job is to live. Ah, but the body got together and said, "Sorry, you have life only for us. You exist for us, the body. You don't have any purpose other than serving the body. Otherwise, you're just plain individualistic." So, they went ahead with taking the veins, turning them aside and becoming arteries. And every day, the three dying arteries are reminded that we still love them because we take a half an aspirin every day. You take a half an aspirin every day?
Right.
Right. So, they are allowed to function as well as they could. But, and we look after them, but we're not taking the energy that should be going into the fullness of life away from, by putting it all onto them. Because what is prior is the body. And that's what we mean by building structures that allow the energy of the group to bypass the obstructions. Now, any leadership is much clearer in business world, in management world, because it's you measure it by pounds, shillings and pence, or by dollars. But in voluntary organizations, it's very much more difficult to measure this. This is the problem. But the reality is that for change, some people want to change, some people are open to change, are renewal people, can cooperate with the creative people. Others just will do nothing about the change whatsoever. And not only not do it, what do? They not just resist.
Undercut,
they seduce. I'm using the word seduction because that's what it is. Seduction. Any questions on that? It's a very powerful. These are very difficult comments. And yes.
You know, I see a problem in change in the sense that they want change and they go for it, and then there's always a group that want to change the change. So you're caught with those that don't want any change.
Right.
Those that have decided on a change, and a definite change, and others that want to go a whole different way with it.
Hmm. This comes to the question of the leadership. The question of the leadership is crucial. Somebody has to make a decision where the change is to take place. There's a limit to democracy, open democracy on everything. You know, for example, I can remember a marvelous group of Franciscan American sisters in the highlands of New Guinea, 10,000 feet up in the mountains. Marvelous. They taught me a marvelous truth. When I went to see them in the early 70s, they had been deeply influenced by leadership communities from the United States. Everybody is a leader, it was said in the chapter in the United States. Everybody's a leader. So we don't need the superior anymore. Well, there wasn't a superior. They recognized they had to have weekly meetings, sometimes even more than weekly meetings, to decide who was going to place the chalk under the blackboard in the school each morning this week. Who was going to throw the rubbish out this week? Who was going to buy the vegetables this week? Who was going to buy the Lawrence Welk records this week? I remember that was quite distinctive, you see. What happened? What do you think happened eventually? Yes, certain individuals became powerful.
No, I meant individualistic.
Right, individualistic, yes. But still, you know, they're having bad, you know, there's a limit to that because, you know, if somebody's not cleaning the bath, then I get into the bath, it's unclean day after day, I get angry, so I go call a meeting. What do you think happened?
Chaos,
yes. Reinvented the superior. They had a meeting, they said, this is ridiculous. All our energies are going into needless meetings. So let us come up with a process whereby somebody is appointed to be the coordinator or leader of the group. And we'll call that person to be accountable. Leadership is crucial to decide which way ultimately to move. He or she must listen. But ultimately somebody must decide to move. Somebody must own the authority to move. And that's the role of the leader. And that's the only way to overcome this type of problem.
What's the difference between leadership involved in deciding whether or not to get chunky peanut butter or real peanut butter by Captain among our communities, or the quantum kind of decisions, the lasting decisions?
Oh, good. You see this question here? It's a crucial question, and it's part of today's work. You've raised a question, Dave. What is the difference between the manager and the leader? Managers are crucial. Managers make sure we've got step ladders. Yes, this morning, in light of this reflection together, I walked past the renovating a new building behind the seminary, and a man walked out with a ladder. I thought, that's the example I want to use today. There was a man walking out with the ladder and another man saying, thanks for getting the ladder. I'm not sure where the ladder should go. Oh, he said there. That's where it should go. The man who supplied the ladder is the manager. The man who decided where the ladder should go is the leader. When you ask the leader to be also the manager, or the manager to be the leader, you have got chaos. Each has a critical function, and in religious life, we have overemphasized the role of the manager and said he or she is the leader. We're speaking about the leader who has the vision, the need, he recognizes or she recognizes the need for creative people to be placed in the right position. He doesn't necessarily decide that. But he must recognize the need for those people. The manager doesn't. Because the manager is concerned with the status quo only.
I once heard the mind that the manager is
one does things right.
That's it. Have you got that? That's the difference. That's the type of distinction we need. And when religious congregations don't make that distinction, it's part of the process of being seduced back into the darkness, into the lack of creativity. Now, just before we look at the prophets, I want to... You see, the example I used of going down here...
Yesterday, I came in here to see another space. Today, suggesting it mightn't be a bad idea to lecture from the reader today. And you recognize, well, eventually if I'm stubborn enough, you're going to have to turn seats around. But you also recognize that there is a resistance. And it's not just at the personal level, it works unconsciously in the group. Now, I'll give you an example of how this works. The insidious nature of it.
Our research team was invited to work with, somewhere in the world, with a group of sisters who run 3 hospitals right up close together, physically together, but they're totally separate hospitals run by the same congregation in an inner city suburb. Because finances were running down, reactive decision making, they should have foreseen this. Because government was running down financially, they had to make one hospital of the 3. Common sense. Well, but common sense doesn't always work in religious life. So I'm told. So the congregation decided in chapter, having written a beautiful mission statement, that they would form one hospital for the glory of God and the honor of Mother Foundress. Unanimous decision. The 3 separate executives of the 3 hospitals were called. All they said, why didn't you think of this before, Mother General? We think it's an excellent idea. So we were called in as consultants to help develop one executive instead of the 3. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Oh, it was an enjoyable experience of bonding. They liked coming together. They didn't see each other often, 3 separate executives. One executive group brought cookies, candies, lunches made up to have an enjoyable picnic with all the others. Oh, they loved it. But we found nothing happening apart from enjoying themselves. It was very interesting that the more we pressed them with the question, what are you going to do, the more they ate chocolates and candy. It was very interesting to watch what was going on. Makes sense. Then, after about the 6th meeting, the 3rd member of our team is a laywoman of incredible dynamism and quite an authority in her own right on management. And she's never one to be standing back. Before lunch, about the 6th meeting, I found her, and I was down the back observing, I found her leaning against the wall, and then she'd lean against the blackboard, and she'd write something on the blackboard, and she'd go up to the podium, and she'd sort of stand here and talk to them like this. And I said, something's going on. Something is fishy. Something smells not good in the English world. So what happens? I said, it's time for lunch. She stops. She said, oh, I feel so tired, she said. I said, Jane, you look tired. They look tired. It's not even the graveyard slot. It's before lunch. They look tired. I said, Jane, go back and create what you were doing. And she did. God, she says, the beggars have seduced me. A bit stronger than that, but I thought I'd better... Australian language can be a bit strong for your ears, I think, but it's quite normal for us. But he said, they've seduced me. And they had. No matter what their words said, down here, they did not want to make one executive. They were avoiding the task, come what may. Oh, they were having a marvelous experience of bonding, of being nice with each other. Oh, they loved it. They were looking forward to the next meeting. But they would not do the work. They would not do the task. The primary task was to form one overarching executive, and they would not do it. And the way to control her was to control her energy. And the way they sat. And she was doing everything and she got exhausted. She was exhausted. And they had succeeded. Straight after lunch, which is the graveyard slot, as you know, as teachers, this is the real difficult time. They came up. She came up. She went unto each of the 17 members. She said, look, I've had enough of this. You said that you wanted to do this. Now look back. You have denied this, 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 and this. Is that true? Oh, gosh, it is. Yes. Now, Dr. Charlie, you also have agreed to this. But now, look, I've got it all written down. This is what you said on the third meeting, it was on the fourth meeting, it was in the first meeting. You are not prepared to do it. Is that true? Well, yes, it is true, she says. You know? She went around to each person. And she uncovered the denial of the individuals and of the group. She threw it right back where it belonged. And the energy level just went explosive. They knew they could not escape her any longer. This is what I mean by how a group, by definition, a group exists for order and predictability. Don't worry about the mission statements. Don't worry about the vision statements. Don't worry about what they might say about creativity. In actual fact, they will seek to seduce that creativity and stop people from doing what is the creative. Well, we'll leave it there. And tonight, this afternoon, during your graveyard reflection... think about, you know, what do you see as some of the applications for your own religious life? And we'll begin tonight at 7, is it? 7 o'clock? No, 4 o'clock is the spirituality one down below. 7 o'clock? 7:15. At 7:15, let's take a bit of space and see now, before we go any further, from your experience, what does this mean? What do you see in the applications in your own experience of this? You probably feel, no, that doesn't apply to me. I'm abnormal. Well, perhaps that may not be the case. Okay. Were you going to say something, Emily?